Hi, I'm Michael Williams and welcome to Blueprint for Living, your weekly guide to the good life. And it's all about building blocks for living today, in particular brightly coloured little plastic ones. We're exploring the relationship between play and creativity. How do things like Lego and Minecraft help us become better, more creative thinkers, both as children and adults?
Something like Lego requires a lot of invention, a lot of craft, and I just find that, you know, that sense of exploration and construction is something that I do every day, 9 to 5.
That's architect Andrew Maynard. I'm not convinced he didn't go into his job just so he'd have an excuse to keep playing with Lego. And hold on to your gag reflex, we're talking food poisoning. It's not just an excuse to get out of work. Any of us who have had it know that it's not worth tempting fate by faking it. We're going to delve into the nonsense and nausea of food poisoning. Plus, we turn our attention to the serious question of risk and responsibility in the travel industry. All that and more coming up on today's show, so stick around.
Zoe Woolmutt was less than a year into a working holiday in Australia when she went on a tour of Kings Canyon in Central Australia with the Rock Tour Company. While climbing onto one of the canyon's ledges to pose for a photo, the 23-year-old fell. Rebecca Gethin was the tour guide on that day and new to the job. I distinctly remember her pink and white top going in and out of view. There was a scream and it took me a moment to register what had happened. She went on to say that climbing down to the ledge at Kestrel Falls for photos was part of the company's itinerary. Photos posted on social media around the time of Miss Woolmer's death showed other tourists posing near the cliff edge.
That was a news report earlier this year from the inquest into the death of 23-year-old British tourist Zoe Woolmer. This week, the Northern Territory coroner handed down his findings into her death, which occurred when she was taking part in a tour led by Alice Springs-based company The Rock Tour. Look, it's such a tragic story and, sadly, such a familiar one. Risk-taking and travel often go hand in hand. But when things go wrong, we have to ask if enough's being done to protect people from harm, particularly young people, I think. And what should the tourism industry be doing about it? Joining me now from Alice Springs is John Sturck, the lawyer who represented Zoe's family at the inquest. And from Cairns we have Mandy Shercor, who's head of law at the College of Business, Law and Governance at James Cook University. Good morning to you both. John, we just heard then about the terrible way that Zoe died. Can you tell us what the inquest heard about the events leading up to her death?
Look, the coroner, Greg Kavner, has an obligation to review effectively systems of safety and the circumstances that lead to unexpected deaths. Obviously, Zoe's was completely unexpected. Her family back in England had said to the coroner that they expected her to be kept safe and away from danger. The positive findings that the coroner made was that the tour company led her to her death. Those were the words that he put to both of the directors, Mr. George and Mr. Cowan. They each agreed with those facts. So it's the worst thought, I suppose, any parent has when you say goodbye to a child to go on a trip, and she'd worked in Sydney for some 9 months. This was her first trip around Australia. Her parents' expectation certainly was that she was going to have a trip, have a lot of fun, meet new people, but more to the point, because she was paying for that trip, she was going to be kept safe and secure from any dangers. And that's really the difference between the self-traveller who takes potentially their own life in their hands, depending on what they do, to those who go on an escorted tour where there's a permit regime to go into the park. The expectation has got to be that the people delivering that service know what they're doing and are going to protect you.
Central to the inquest findings was the fact that the stunt photos, the selfies like this, were a kind of common practice. They were central to the practice of these tours and these tour guides. What kind of evidence was given about how commonplace that was?
There were a number of former guides who'd worked for the tour company who'd volunteered and give evidence to the coroner's constable fairly early on. That was volunteered information. There was some debate about whether or not the relationships between those ex-employees and the current directors was friendly or fairly unfriendly, but the coroner's view was that it certainly demonstrated circumstances where, at best, it could be said that it was convenient for the directors not to resolve their suspicions about what was being marketed. I think the reality is that for this tour sector, for potentially the Y generation, you're going to be selling your tours to your overseas backpacker market by your online presence, and their point of difference potentially was they were out there doing the more exciting stuff.
Was there sufficient safety training for the guides?
Strangely, in the Territory, it's a perennial issue. Within the Commonwealth parks, like Ayers Rock or Catajuta, it's mandatory now for tour guides to have some training. Within the Territory parks at the time, there wasn't such a requirement. Obviously, this trip was going to be going both to Kings Canyon and Uluru Catajuta, but there is no specific training, but it was certainly something that the coroner did focus on, and in the course of the inquest, the Parks and Wildlife Commission of the Territory had developed what was called a six-point plan, which was to obviously better regulate what they did in terms of ensuring safety standards and adequately trained guides were attending within the park.
So when it comes to regulation, Mandy Sherkor, what legislation governs who's liable when something goes wrong on tour groups like this?
Well, there's sort of a complex web of legislation and common law that both protects the consumers of the recreational services and also the recreational service providers to some extent. As was previously mentioned, there are state and territory licensing and regulation and permits required for governing the tourism industry, particularly for those taking people to national parks and environmentally sensitive areas. There's work, health and safety national uniform legislation that also provides uniform framework to protect the health, safety and welfare of all workers at work and, importantly, of other people who might be affected by the work. That legislation provides codes of practice on how to meet the standards set out in the National Health and Safety National Uniform legislation. And it also provides duties of care to persons conducting a business or undertaking to ensure, so far as is reasonably practical, the health and safety of ensuring that persons are not put at risk.
Mandy, John mentioned the way in which the idea of risk or the idea of danger is kind of central to a lot of these tour practices. Can you talk to us a bit about the nature of kind of dangerous recreational activity and how that fits into this?
Yes, well, certainly, in relation to that particular legislation, there are offences for duty holders, that is, people carrying out businesses or undertakings or workers within those businesses. There are offences where they do not without reasonable excuse engage in conduct that recklessly exposes a person to a risk of death or serious injury. So there are offences under that Act where people, recreational providers, engage in that sort of activity. There are also, however, in some states and jurisdictions in Australia, civil liability legislation that provides for a defence where a person engages in a dangerous recreational activity and as a result of engaging in that dangerous recreational activity, an obvious risk materialises that causes them harm. And there have been instances in some states where those dangerous recreational activity provisions have been tested, and recreational providers have relied on or attempted to rely on those provisions.
Give us the example. Give us the example of the Lake Wabi case on Fraser Island, which I understand was one of those tests of that idea about obvious risk.
Yes, the case was the state of Queensland and Kelly, which went to the Queensland Court of Appeal. And in that case, a tour had been taken of young backpackers to the Lake Wabi area at Fraser Island. Now, that lake is renowned as being a deep lake, and it has steep sand dunes that run down to the lake. And it was a common practice of people to run down those sand dunes and sort of topple into the lake and jump into the lake, which was very deep. Now, there were... the tour guides had, prior to the tourists taking the tourists onto the island, they were required to view a film about the inherent dangers of Fraser Island. And the film included a warning about diving into shallow waters, but it only portrayed sort of a very shallow-looking creek. And in the walk up to Lake Wobbe, there was also a sign that depicted the dangers of diving into water, and it showed sort of a jagged rock underneath. But when the group of tourists arrived at the Lake Wobbe, they saw many other people running down the sand dunes and into the lake. And the plaintiff and his friends, certainly there was no discouragement by the tour guides, ran down the sand dunes and into the lake. And on one instance, the plaintiff lost his footing at the bottom, or the sort of sand gave way, and he fell headfirst into the very edge of the lake where it was shallow, and as a result suffered tetraplegia.
That relationship between active encouragement and perceived encouragement is really important here. One thing the Northern Territory coroner did say in the findings this week into the Zoe Woolmer death was that in a guided tour, a person may well not make their own risk assessment and be influenced by others. Does that make matters more complicated?
It does, because in this particular case, for example, the argument was that it was an obvious risk. The defendant claimed it was an obvious risk that if you run down these sand dunes at high speed, there is an obvious risk that you'll be injured. But the court did hold that you must look at the obvious risk in context and whether the risk is obvious to a reasonable person in the position of the injured party. And this person had seen many people running down into the lake, and the warning signs that had been given were held not to be sufficient, and that the risk of this sort of serious injury occurring was not, in fact, obvious in the circumstances.
John Sturck, the Northern Territory Parks and Wildlife Commission issued a statement this week saying it would implement all of the coroner's recommendations, including the ones on the management of permits. Is that of some comfort to Zoe Woolmer's family?
Look, obviously the family's main wish was to make sure that this didn't happen to someone else. So anything that can be done that achieves that outcome was obviously pleasing to them. The Parks and Wildlife Commission were fairly forthright and did concede that to an extent they had been asleep at the wheel. There is always a tension, I think, between any park service that encourages tourism into its park having responsibilities to have some monitoring of what goes on. The coroner said it's no use having half a system where you encourage people in, but there's no sanction if they transgress. And the other issue I suspect that we have is perhaps the difference in the way in which we in Australia approach parks to other jurisdictions. In the US, if we were talking about a similar park, the expectation may well be we'll have the whole top of the ridge line fence so people can't fall over. But even that's not going to necessarily protect people if they clamber through, which was really the case in these circumstances where there was signage telling people not to do the activity that did occur.
Thank you both for your time. John Sturck is the lawyer for Zoe Woolmer's family at the inquest, and Mandy Shercor is head of law at James Cook University in Cairns. And we should say, too, that we did ask the lawyers for the Rock Tour Company for a statement in response to the inquest findings, but were told the company would not be commenting. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN.
This year's El Niño event could be one of the biggest on record.
This summer, as the heat sets in, we want to know how your part of Australia is changing. Describe the before, during and after summer in words and pictures. From the pot plant to the paddock, stories from a big landscape. It'll be your summer diary online. There's a tips and tricks page to get you started. Just look for Hot Summer Land on the RN homepage. Everything is awesome.
Are you playing with Lego, Felix?
I'm trying to find the stair.
What do you want to make with the steering wheel?
A boat. A rescue boat. Here's the steering wheel. It's going to spin really fast and bang into rocks. And that's my game.
Sounds like a fun game. What else can you make out of the Lego?
A dinosaur.
Let's see what bits we can get that can make a dinosaur. Do you want to help, Greta?
Yeah. Here is the neck.
I found the head, but where's the eye?
Eyes. Hair.
It's only hair.
That is very cute. That's Felix and Greta playing Lego with their mum, Blueprint producer Kathy Pryor. Now, you may not have recognised that song at the start as being from the Lego movie. You may not have stood on a piece of Lego lately and sworn loudly. But pretty much all of us recognise the role those ubiquitous interlocking little blocks play in our culture, our parenting, and our development as creative minds. This is what we're interested in this morning, the intersection between play and creativity. Michael DeJuani is the Deputy Director of the Children and Youth Research Centre at Queensland's University of Technology. He's done a fair bit of research into the value games such as Minecraft can have in creative learning in schools. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Very well. And Paige Moreau teaches product innovation at the University of Wisconsin in the US. She was recently involved in an experiment with students to see what impact playing with Lego has on problem solving and creativity. And she joins us now via Skype. Paige, tell us a little bit about the experiment you did with Lego with your university students. What were they asked to do?
Hi, Michael. Thank you. Well, we had them do two different tasks. We had one group play with the loose blocks for about the same amount of time that another group put together the kit from instructions. And what we were really interested in is how they performed on a task following that Lego playtime to see if they would perform better or worse on a creative task. And we also had a control task.
This is the great age-old dilemma of Lego, is whether following the instructions or doing your own thing is more useful. What did your study find?
Well, we found, because we had a control group, we could tell whether the play increased creativity or following the instructions decreased it. And sadly, we found that when they put the kits together and followed the instructions, they performed less creatively on a secondary task than either the control group or the group that had played with the Legos.
What do you think's behind that? How much is that about a kind of problem-solving mentality rather than an instruction-following one?
Right. So we did a follow-up study to try and understand, because there are really two different things that are going on. One is following step-by-step instructions, and the other is trying to achieve a singular correct answer. And it turned out in a follow-up study that it was trying to focus on a singular correct answer that decreased the creativity. It wasn't following the instructions per se that did it.
So you specifically teach product innovation. So creativity is the outcome you're looking for. Do you think you can teach creativity to adults?
That's a great question as well. And we've done some research on that too. We all come in with an innate level of creative ability, and it differs across individuals based on their background and experiences. But what we found is that significant differences and improvement if you give people some sort of an intervention and put them in the right mindset or give them a training task to prepare them to go into a creative session. So I'm not sure we can train them long term, but certainly in the short term, we can improve their performance.
Andrew Maynard is a Melbourne-based architect who was a Lego fan as a kid, and he continues to play with Lego in his adult life. He's such a fan that his architecture office is often dotted with the Lego models he's built. I spoke to him earlier this week, and this is what he had to say about how games, and Lego in particular, feed his creativity.
Games are pretty important to me. I fill a lot of hours of my day. It lends the sort of elasticity that you need for creative thinking. Something like Lego requires a lot of invention, a lot of craft, and I just find that, you know, that sense of exploration and construction is something that I do every day, 9 to 5. My architecture is all about borrowing more than anything rather than inventing. So I've always found it weird when people say that, oh, look, you've got to just buy the raw blocks and then let your creativity go wild. I really enjoy getting the pre-designed Lego and giving that a crack, putting it together. It's interesting when you see kids do that because they immediately pull it apart, which I think is heartbreaking for some parents. I just think that using those kits is a learning tool, and you've just got to have the bravery then to tear it all to bits and start again.
Paige Morrow, what do you think of what Andrew has to say there about the impact of Lego on his creative thinking? Does that surprise you, or is it consistent with what you found in your study?
Not at all. I think it's great. So there is research that's been done that shows that you need constraints to spark the creativity. And so with the kit, you get some of that structure that you need. And then the real key that he was talking about is the ability and willingness to tear it apart once you've put it together and to reinvent it. And so I think moving into that trial and error element is really successful. When you start with a completely blank slate, we actually tend to freeze and create stuff that we can easily recall from memory, and therefore it's not usually all that creative.
I don't know if you saw it, but Brian Eno gave this great lecture earlier this year in the UK where he talked about creativity, and he said, children learn through play, but adults play through art. How does something like this help us in fields outside the creative field, say in the business world?
Oh, well, I think the play is key. I mean, I think it really does. And he had a nice way of saying it with the elasticity. If you play, you really set up a situation that encourages this trial and error motion. And you allow yourself to revel in the ambiguity and to test things out. I think as adults, we tend to be terrified of failure. And I think across business situations and a lot of other situations in life, it's that fear of failure that stifles our ability to innovate.
Well, we're in serious danger of making this a bit of product placement for Lego. So let's broaden the conversation now and move it to other pastimes that have taken off in recent years. Of course, computer games are the big thing, and the behemoth in the world of computer games that encourage creativity is Minecraft. It's built a veritable empire around itself, both amongst kids and passionate adults. Before we get to Michael DeJuani, let's hear what Andrew Maynard has to say about Minecraft in particular.
I pumped in a lot of hours into Minecraft, but I found that I had to get out of that because I was simply doing what I do at work, which is just constantly building and building. So it felt stressful, almost like the same type of work.
I am not a Minecraft person. Like, I like different games, but Minecraft is one that I've never even kind of delved into, partly because I suspect I would become obsessed. For our listeners who are like me, talk us through, what is the premise there? How does that set up?
So it is an open world game that really has no rules. It's very simple blocks. It's almost got this 80s pixelated look to it, but it's in three dimensions. And there's a couple of ways that you can go at it. There's adventure mode, so you can actually get in there and start. You know, you've got to survive the first night. You've got to quickly dig a hole and put a door on it and survive. But from that fundamental premise of you need to create shelter to survive the first night, that sort of spirals off endlessly the more time you put in there, because that shelter can become something incredibly elaborate.
Michael DeJuani, you've been interested in the way Minecraft can be used in schools in particular to enhance creative thinking among kids. Tell us a little bit about what you've been looking at there.
Sure. Well, we've been conducting a study into the use of games in education for the past 3 years called the Serious Play Project. And this has occurred in 10 schools across Queensland and Victoria. And what became very apparent to us very quickly was that, you know, Minecraft was about the most popular game for children and young people in the classes we were working with. And in fact, eventually about six of the teachers ended up using Minecraft throughout the project to have the students learn and to be creative and so on.
Just to check, is this primary schools or secondary schools that you're focused on?
It was actually across primary schools and secondary schools, but I think four of the schools that were doing Minecraft were primary schools.
The kind of thinking around the role of computer games in creativity and education is a pretty divided territory. I mean, they get a bit of bad press in some circles. Why do you think that is? And do you think there are some generic things that can be said about the role of computer games for kids, or do you think they should be taken on a case-by-case basis?
I really do think they should be taken on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think that one of the reasons games historically get a bad rap is because many of the most high-profile games are violent, you know, first-person shooter games and so on, and people see their teenagers off playing those games and get concerned that they're learning all sorts of habits that might be antisocial and so on, although that's, you know, not necessarily borne out by the research around those kinds of games. I think that when teachers start thinking about games, they initially start thinking about skill and drill type games. So, you know, a game like Mathletics is very popular in primary schools because it's teaching kids those basic math skills. In the project that we conducted, we were really interested to see how we could push games further to see what might be possible precisely with creativity and broader literacy development with the use of games. It did take some time for us to kind of work with the teachers to get them thinking about ways that they might actually use games in that kind of broader way. There's a lot of pressure on to, you know, have kids be successful with their literacy and numeracy development, and so, you know, suggesting to them that we might bring a game into the classroom to develop creativity is, you know, is not necessarily what they want to hear or what they perhaps have time for.
Paige, your study is focused on Lego, and I'm curious about the extent to which it's the physical building with blocks is a component or not. Have you looked into the comparison between that and computer-based things when it comes to creative process and development?
No, I haven't looked directly at that, and I think it's a great idea because if you look at Minecraft, it's really sort of an infinite way to play with Legos in some sense, and I think without the instructions, which is also the important part. But there would be something interesting about examining whether it's the tactile versus the virtual, and to understand if this fear of failure and other emotional components differ significantly between the kids' experience with the tactile versus the virtual.
But the notion of infinite in teaching creativity, how useful is the infinite? How much do we need parameters when it comes to teaching creativity to kids? Do you have any thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, I think the thing about Minecraft is that the infiniteness of it, if you like, you know, I think I would put it more in terms of its openness. So, you know, many games are structured, and we were talking earlier about, you know, the constraints of structure and, you know, how we're often required, with Lego to, you know, start off with a kit and make it in a certain way. There is a kind of loose structure within Minecraft that Andrew was alluding to earlier around, you know, having to survive. If you're playing in survival mode, you have to create a structure so that you're safe for monsters and so on. But once you get past that initial phase of the game, it really is open for you to do whatever you want with the game. And one of the things that was really interesting to us when we started talking to children about this was that they were entering the game in a whole host of different kinds of ways and experimenting with their entry point into the game. So for some kids, it was about going off and fighting monsters and so on. For other kids, it was about starting that block construction type play to build structures and so on. But other kids were doing quite innovative things like, you know, playing hide and seek with monsters, for instance.
I've been speaking with Michael Dejuani. He's Deputy Director of the Children and Youth Research Centre at the Queensland University of Technology, and Paige Moreau, Academic Director of the Centre for Brand and Product Management at the University of Wisconsin, as we've unpicked the link between play and creativity. And before we finish up with this, let's just listen to one last word from architect Andrew Maynard about the importance of play and how it's contributed to his work as an architect.
Play is just fundamental to humans, and kids just do it. You don't even need to encourage them to do it. And if you stand back and watch, kids will just invent in ways that you don't expect. And I think you need to let them do that because, yeah, as we get older, we start to construct or learn this construction about how we should be interacting. There's certain steps that I take when I'm designing something or things that I remind myself about, such as take the labels off things. So if you start thinking about functions too much, you know, you start to draw things a certain way instead of actually breaking them down to key components of what the human animal probably needs rather than what a real estate agent wants you to have in your house. So that's actually pretty hard as an adult because we have been told how things are meant to function. And if you can somehow step away from that, I think you get a lot more out of your design.
If there's a unifying human experience, it's illness and physical infirmity. And in the world of the sympathetic Lurgy horror story, is there anything that comes close to the horror that is food poisoning? Anyone who saw the 2011 film Bridesmaid will recall a particularly memorable scene where a posh dress fitting is, let's say, interrupted. Let's hear a little bit from that scene, but I should warn you, it might be best to put down anything you're eating. This is going to get a bit gross.
That dress is so pretty, it makes my stomach hurt.
I don't know what to say. You look... Megan, are you okay? Oh.
I think my dress was probably just tight.
Oh, my God. You got food poisoning from that restaurant, didn't you?
Oh, my. Okay.
Oh, no.
Not the bathroom. Everybody, go outside. I'm serious. There's a bathroom across the street.
Oh, it chills down the spine just even thinking about it. It's very clammy, people. Claudine Ryan is editor of the ABC's health and wellbeing website, and she's with me. Not only has she intensively researched food poisoning over the years, but she's also done some field research herself. She's a survivor. Claudine, tell us your horror story.
Well, I was almost like the witness to the horror, really. It was about a year ago, and we had a couple of confirmed cases of the notifiable variety at my place. My husband and toddler got salmonella, and frankly, it wasn't funny.
No.
Even though that scene was. It was awful, really awful. And it really made me aware, like I was already aware of, food safety and preparing food safely. But I tell you what, it really made me a lot more vigilant around certain things.
Well, it's not just awful. It can be really frightening. I mean, we live in a very privileged country where, for the most part, severe food poisoning isn't a major issue. Do you know how you got your dose of salmonella?
Yeah, well, we suspect because, you know, when there's a house of five people and only two people get sick, it gets easier to kind of narrow down, you know, the
process of elimination.
Salmon mousse, so to speak. And it wasn't salmon mousse. It was just an egg on a Sunday morning. It was so harmless. We just had eggs and my husband cooked them as we normally had them, so not totally runny but a little soft in the centre. And the toddler didn't finish his egg, so my husband finished it off. And that was that, 12 hours later. It was awful. It went for probably the better part of 10 days and they both lost a significant percentage of their body weight.
Oh, that is seriously frightening stuff. So help us. You've done the research off the back of that and in your role in the health and wellbeing part of the ABC website. So talk us through some of the myths and some of the kind of false ideas and assumptions people have about this stuff. So, like, the basic one is I pull leftovers out of the fridge and I think somehow my superior sense of smell is going to tell me whether they're still good to eat or not. Is there anything in that or is that just foolhardy?
No way. There's nothing in that. And I had to follow up on this because someone was staying with us once and they did this very thing. They pulled stuff. This is before the food poisoning, really. They pulled stuff out of our fridge. They gave it a big sniff and went, oh, that's great. And I actually knew it had been in the back of that fridge for a good 2 weeks. And so I followed up with, leading experts, as is my job. And they, confirmed my suspicions that, so spoilage bacteria, so the things that make food smell funky or look awful or taste a bit off, are quite different to the bacteria or that cause food poisoning. So something can look and smell and taste delicious, but it can still make you ill.
Right. So the opposite is true. If it smells funky, then there's a reasonable chance that it's not going to make you feel great. But the absence of that smell isn't a sign that it's a green light.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's other things to keep in mind. And yes, I wouldn't be going for the sniff test at all.
So at a scientific level, what are the bacteria that cause food poisoning? Your salmonella or your E. coli or listeria? How does it work?
So there's salmonella. Well, so there's a couple of different things going on. So you can get food poisoning from bacteria, so salmonella or campylobacter is another common one. E. coli or Listeria. You've probably heard of all of these. And then there are also viruses and parasites that can be responsible for food poisoning. So that's more like a, you know, there's norovirus is a common virus. In fact, it's the most common cause of foodborne illness in Australia. And then there's also parasites, and that's more like a Giardia type thing. And so these can be present on the food when you get it, and you can kind of, your food can kind of cross-contaminate, or it can be that someone is ill and they prepare the food and they contaminate the food and then give it to you. So a good rule of thumb is, you know, if someone's sick, don't eat any food they prepare for you. Or if you are sick with a vomiting diarrhea, don't prepare food for other people.
It seems like a pretty good basic starting point. Also, I don't know how brutal your house is, but I would like to think that if I'm sick, I get off cooking duties for the night. You never know. So if we can't trust the scientific sniff test as a way to make sure that we're looking after food safety in our homes, do you have some basic tips for how to be kind of cautious and preventative?
Well, look, there are a lot of, certain foods are high risk and they require particular attention. But really any food can carry some, you know, risk.
Any food, I hear, maybe it's urban myth, but there are certain foods that you associate with food poisoning that you hear again and again, that rice or potato can carry it, or chicken is dicey. Are there particular ones that are higher risk?
Absolutely. So in Australia, the two biggies tend to be chicken and eggs. And then there are others that I'm happy to kind of talk about. So maybe if I go and break it down kind of by food. So when it comes to, often when you hear about, you know, when you hear those cases of mass food poisoning, salmonella at a restaurant or a catering event, and it always seems to be the mayo. And
yes, it does.
That is because that's a raw egg dish. So any dish, mayo, tiramisu, mousse, aioli,
anything. You're listing my favourite things here. This is heartbreaking.
Yeah, sorry. Any of those foods, they can carry a risk of salmonella, and minimally cooked foods made with minimally or cooked eggs or raw eggs are the single largest cause of salmonella outbreaks in Australia. So the things that you should do are, make sure that you store your eggs in the fridge and use them while they're fresh. So don't use old eggs for these dishes. Ditch any cracked or broken eggs. Don't use the shell to separate your egg white from your yolk. And that's because the bacteria can sit on the outside of the egg in eggshell, so the inside is protected. But the minute that you bring the inside of the egg in contact with the shell, then you start, then there's the contamination can occur. And so it's then a matter of time before the bacteria spread throughout the food. So you want to do a bunch of things that are going to reduce the risk of whatever, if there was bacteria on the outside of the egg, coming in contact with what was inside the egg. And then the less time there is between when you make the food with the raw or minimally cooked egg and when you eat it, that's all going to reduce the risk. So make small batches of these foods and eat them straight away, or refrigerate them straight away. Don't serve them to at-risk groups. So that's pregnant women, small children, elderly people, or people with compromised immune systems. And for those of you with backyard chooks who have their own eggs.
Judging from comments on our website, a lot of our listeners are having their own eggs laid in the backyard. Surely that's safer, or a control mechanism.
Well, not necessarily. And one of the things that you want to be careful with is when you buy commercial eggs, they are washed, and they do it in such a way that they don't run the same contamination risks that you're going to encounter if you wash your eggs at home. So the Food Safety Council says you shouldn't wash your eggs that you get from your backyard chooks, but what you should do is wipe them down with a dry cloth or paper towel, and then, and I say this as someone who has a busy functioning kitchen at home, be sure to make sure if you do wipe it with a cloth that you put the cloth in the washing machine and don't then use it to wipe the bench down or whatever. As well, try and collect those eggs out of the backyard, from your chook you know, from where your chickens are roosting every day, and store them in the fridge, but away from foods that may become contaminated and a risk. So away from your salad veggies and your, you know, the foods that aren't going to be cooked. So there's that egg storage. Most fridges have an egg storage section.
I am surprised by the non-washing advice. I mean, they're a basic kind of old wives' tale ideas about running anything under a tap and making it okay. Does the same thing apply for chicken? Should we not be washing our chicken?
Yeah, no, there's a big thing about washing chicken. People are, it never occurred to me to wash chicken, but there's a whole bunch of people who do wash chicken. But really, we shouldn't wash chicken because chicken is a source of another very common cause of a bacteria that commonly causes food poisoning in Australia, Campylobacter. And it's on a lot of raw chicken. If I tell you the percentage, it's shocking.
Go on, frighten me.
80% of raw chicken in Australia, studies have found up to 80% of it is contaminated with Campylobacter. And this is not a problem if you cook the chicken properly. But when you wash raw chicken in a kitchen, the potential for spraying that bacteria and cross-contamination is much higher. So you want to try, and the idea is to try and get your chicken and any kind of juices or whatever that are in the chicken kind of into your oven or wherever you're going to cook it with minimal steps along the way, because every time you put it in a new place or on a new surface or, you know, play around with it, you increase the chance of cross-contaminating surfaces or other foods or whatnot.
That takes me to another kind of myth that I've always chosen to believe, which is if you cook it hot enough, you'll cook off any bugs or whatever. Can we just be throwing things in the microwave and nuking the food poisoning out of them?
Well, they say that, you know, you want to get things up to a high temperature and that will kill a lot of bacteria, but it's not going to help if it's a toxin that's making you unwell. And so this leads us to another kind of, it's not a common cause of food poisoning, but it is definitely a known one, and that is cooked rice. So rice can be contaminated with a bacteria called Bacillus cereus. And so when you cook the rice, the process doesn't kill these kind of heat resistance spores. So when you cook the rice and then it starts to cool, the bacteria thrive and produce toxins. And so these toxins, say you get a batch of rice and you cook your rice and the Bacillus cereus, you know, is activated, and then you let the rice sit on the stovetop overnight because tomorrow morning you're going to make fried rice. By the time you come and then cook that rice in the morning, you may well kill some more of the bacteria, but the toxins aren't going to go away.
Claudine, you've left me thinking the only option is the basic rule: when in doubt, chuck it out. Thank you so much. Claudine Ryan is editor of the ABC's Health and Wellbeing website. A quiz about the best things to do in food poisoning is going up on our website. You should be able to ace it off the back of what you've just heard. And we want to hear your worst ever food poisoning stories. No, really, we do. The grosser, the better. Leave a comment on this story or on our Facebook page. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams. With me is food critic, author and TV presenter Matt Preston, and he's giving us the top tips for conquering that everyday bit of cooking. Matt, your tip for the perfect barbecue?
Well, I think there are 12 simple secrets to the perfect barbecue. Number one, clean the thing. Number two, choose your meat well. You don't have to have a pile of meat. Small quantities of good meat is the way to go and bulk up on the veggies. The barbecue is obviously not just for meat. I love corn on the barbecue, is a great thing, but thick slabs of eggplant as well. Get that lovely smokiness, char on the outside, creamy in the middle. Obviously, marinades and rubs are a simple way of adding flavour. I love using processed onions, so blitz your onions so they become watery, and use that in terms of marinating your lamb chops. You'll find they get really tender for about 2 hours. The other thing that's amazing for pork is pineapple juice. So, you know, take your pineapple, blitz it, use the pulp to make a chutney, and use the juice. Just sit your pork chops in your juice, your pork fillet in your juice, and you'll find it within an hour, again, it softens it down and makes it delicious. Buy a meat thermometer. Will cost you between $20 to $40 depending on where you go, and you will never overcook a bit of meat again. assuming you use it, I've given endless meat thermometers to my father-in-law. He leaves them in the drawer, and then we get grey meat again. But I think he probably just likes it that way. Oil what you're putting on the grill rather than the grill. But, you know, using less oil is important. Cook things from room temperature if you want them to cook through. Obviously, the great thing with a steak, if you want a steak that's got a good crust on the outside and is still kind of rare in the middle, if it comes from the fridge, you're going to achieve that. I think it's really important to use the flatbed of the plancha, the flat plate in terms of doing onions. Do two things at once. The next thing is remember to use direct and indirect heat. I find cooking chicken, like breasts, which are quite thick, you know, searingly hot, preheat the grill, get it really hot, then take it off the heat, indirect heat, let it kind of cook through slowly and finish it hot again. You'll get really succulent, juicy chicken. That meat plate you bring the meat out on, don't take the meat back on. You've got to have another bit of plate. We know that, but we tend to forget about that. And when you finish, clean the barbecue again so that you won't have to clean it when all the fat's congealed on there. And that they are the basic tips.
Food critic, writer and TV presenter Matt Preston's book, The Simple Secrets to Cooking Everything Better, is in good bookshops now. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN. Now from the kitchen to the garden, and in the USA, more people visit gardens than go to Disneyland and Disney World combined. That is a fact I have no doubt would have thrilled our resident botanist Tim Entwistle. He caught up with the finder of this fact on a windy beach at Wollongong in New South Wales.
Hi there, I'm Richard Benfield. I'm Professor of Geography and Chair of the Department of Geography and a biogeographer at Central Connecticut State University, New Britain, Connecticut, in the United States.
Now, you've been described as the world expert on botanic gardens tourism, but there's a qualifier to that, isn't it?
Well, the great qualifier, and it comes from a very great authority and one that you have to always obey, which is my daughter, who's very strident and very insistent that if ever that is mentioned in public, I also have to mention I'm actually the only one, so I could very well be the worst.
Now, we're sitting on a beach which is relatively popular at the moment. It's not its peak summer, but a lot of people go to the beach here in Australia. We know people go shopping, we know they go to pubs. Where do botanic gardens fit into all that?
From an international perspective, botanic gardens arguably are the number two destination that foreign visitors would like to see after national parks. And then there's only a certain number that immediately spring to mind, Kakadu, for example. And so botanic gardens and yours in Melbourne and Adelaide and Sydney and Perth are very strong performers in terms of numbers of people and importance of botanic gardens in the world of tourism.
Now, is that all people? Because one of the things we often struggle with in botanic gardens is we think it's an ageing community. We think people, they might come there when they're a kid, but then they come back when they're older. So are you finding all people, or are there particular groups that are harder to get there?
Yes, I think you're right, Tim. It's a myth. We have a large number of visitors. Most of the gardens that I've surveyed, and I'm certainly more knowledgeable of American gardens, but certainly Australian gardens, have a wide range of age groups. The so-called millennial generation of young people.
Now let me stop you then. Tell me about the millennials. Now, you better define them and tell me a bit about them.
Well, the millennials are aged 18 to 34. They're essentially the baby boom product. And with a dying of baby boomers, the millennials now constitute the largest demographic cohort in places like Australia and America. And so as a consuming group, as a tourism group, as any kind of cohort you want to look at, they are very important.
And what do these millennials like to do? So what's their typical weekend for them?
Oh, as yet we don't know, and that's fair to say, but some of the things that they do is very interesting. They certainly stay home more than we anticipated they would. Many of them don't drive. In my part of the world, in the United States, 28% of millennials don't have driver's license. They're not driving anymore, but they love entertainment, they're prepared to pay for it, they consume voraciously, but only certain kinds of things. And in our industry, in the botanic garden industry and the food industry, they are very picky and very, very targeted in terms of what they will and won't eat and what they do. So in terms of us in botanic gardens, not only do they represent a potential market, we're finding actually they are a very good market. They come to botanic gardens, and that's not a bad thing.
Now, why do they come to botanic gardens? One of the things we soul search for all the time in botanic gardens is, are they coming there for those lovely labels we put on the plants and the wonderful education, the wonderful interpretation we spend time on? Is that why the millennials that do come?
Well, before I tell you that, Tim, and answer that, let me tell you of a garden that I know of in New York that is the only garden where young Jewish males and young Jewish females can go without a chaperone to court, to form alliances. So there's one good reason why young people go to botanic gardens. They're not being watched out for what anything they might do in the botanic garden, which you as a botanic garden manager, I'm sure, would be appalled if some of the things that got on. But no, on a more generic or more general note, they come primarily, I think it's fair to say, for beauty. They come for social purposes, to be with the people they want to be with. But having said that, they're still quite receptive to some of the goals and objectives and missions of botanic gardens, namely conservation and preservation and learning about the plant world. And that's not a bad thing as well.
So if you look around at Australian gardens, I know you've visited quite a few over the years. What would you say that we do well, not just for the millennials, but for visitors generally, and perhaps things that we could improve on as well?
The flora right off the bat is really very interesting to people. I've seen flora that I just couldn't even believe as what it is. So what do you do well? You show off your native species, I think, very well. And I think that's really the answer to your question, whether it be Arid Lands Botanic Gardens, whether it be your gardens in Melbourne, whether it be here in Wollongong and the Gold Coast Gardens. Really show off native plants to the visitor. And I presume, and I hope this is true, horticulturally you're doing a job for them as well. But no, you do that very, very well. And I think you display them very well. And I think that's a fair comment in terms of what I find in botanic gardens in Australia.
Now, and we also spend a lot of time these days in botanic gardens around the world talking about conservation. We talk about how our life depends on plants, how important they are, and there's subtle and not so subtle messages there. Mm-hmm. Do you think visitors get those messages when they come to gardens?
I think the jury is still out on that, Tim, quite honestly. I think we try very hard to give that message, and that's not a bad thing. I think there are other conservation messages that have a leg over on us in the sense that whale watching is watching a species which apparently is highly endangered. You may go to a zoo because it's full of endangered animals. I think we in the horticultural or the plant world don't have that sense of urgency, and some would say we're not that sexy as a drowning polar bear, heaven forbid. And so we're in many ways a little behind the eight ball in trying to get the attention of the conservation-minded populace. But having said that, I think we're dedicated to it. We're doing it. We have to be careful. We don't overdo it. I have to tell you, I was in New York Botanic Garden not so long ago, and a lady turned to her husband and said, "If they blame me for the disappearance of the rainforest one more time, I'm gonna scream." And well, I think we've done a lot of that in botanic gardens, filling people with guilt.
I've also heard you talk about the fact that botanic gardens and gardens more generally use all the senses, and I think that's a fascinating point. That you go out into a garden, you touch, smell, whatever all those other senses are, you hear things. It seems to be a point of difference there.
Tim, I am really very intrigued with that whole area, and I'm glad you brought it up because it actually is one of my research areas. And I'm off the bat, and I hope you don't get offended by this as a botanic garden manager, but a botanic garden is the only cultural, maybe physical art form where you can smell, touch, feel, taste, all of the here, you know. I mean, granted, I'm sure some of them are pulling the leaves off your mint to have a smell, but that's a marvelous thing. You cannot do that in art galleries. They won't let you help the art along with a few, you know, eyeglasses and a moustache on the painting. So we're very, very lucky in that regard. And now we're finding out from the people that go to gardens and do these tactile things, touching, just how important they are physiologically, psychologically, and in terms of social networks. I'll give you an example which I think is very, very interesting. I have data, and I'd be glad to share with anyone, that in Las Vegas casinos, gaming revenues go up 40% when you pump lavender smells into the casino. The enjoyment of the individual who's gaming, whether it be pulling a slot machine or playing poker, 42% is kind of significant. And the research is easy. Shut off the lavender in one room and your revenues go down 40%.
Thanks. Richard Benfield from Central Connecticut State University in the US on Wollongong Beach.
Head of the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, Tim Entwistle, and we will be hearing much more of Tim over summer when his Talking Plants series returns in December at 10 a.m. Saturdays here on RN. Coming up on today's Blueprint for Living, though, Cheryl Strayed, the best-selling and celebrated author of Wild, is taking us for a walk along the Pacific Crest Trail. You might want to hang on to your toenails. It's quite a journey. That's coming up in just a minute.
Sorry, you have to walk 1,000 miles just to...
Finish that sentence. Why do I have to walk 1,000 miles?
Happy trail, Cheryl.
Turn away from the sound of your own voice.
You get lonely.
I'm lonelier in my real life than I am out here.
Follow the avalanche.
Must have been some breakup, huh?
Breakup is sort of a shorthand.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living, and today's sense of place promises to be something special. That clip you just heard was from last year's film Wild. It starred Reese Witherspoon, and she was masquerading as our guest today. When we ask our guests for a place or a journey that's defined them or changed their life, it's rarely as pronounced and as all-consuming as it was in the case of Cheryl Strayed. For 94 days, she hiked 1,700 kilometres alone along the Pacific Crest Trail, a continuous wilderness undulating from Mexico to Canada over 9 mountain ranges. Her moving and powerful account of that journey made up her best-selling and acclaimed memoir, Wild, which I adored. It's a wonderful book. In fact, turn off your radio, go and read it, and then come back. We'll wait for you. Author, memoirist, advice columnist, podcaster, and hiker, Cheryl Strayed, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It's lovely to have you here. I want to take you back before the Pacific Crest Trail first. You grew up in rural Minnesota.
I did.
Did you have a relationship with the natural world from a young age?
A really important one. Actually, when I was about 12, my family moved to northern Minnesota. We lived on 40 acres of what was essentially wilderness. We were the first people to ever build on that land. My family and I built a house together, and we lived back to the land style without indoor plumbing or running water or electricity for many of the years of my teenagehood. It wasn't, as a teenager, the way I would have chosen to live, but it did teach me about how to be in the woods and how to be in the wilderness and feel safe there.
I'm not convinced that teenagers should be allowed to choose how they live anyway, so I think it's probably not a bad thing.
That's right. No, exactly. And my mother would always say, when I would complain about, you know, having an outhouse, for example, she'd say it's character building. And she was right.
I'm not sure you know that you want character when you're a teenager.
You never think you want character.
So for you, getting outside, getting into wilderness was always a means of connection of some sort?
It was, you know, and I think that a lot of people, when they read Wild and talk about Wild, they overlook that piece of it. I came from the wilderness, and when I was in my darkest hour, I returned to the wilderness to find that sense of wholeness and strength and serenity.
There's a beautiful passage early in the book where you say, "The Pacific Crest Trail wasn't a world to me then. It was an idea, vague and outlandish, full of promise and mystery. Something bloomed inside me as I traced its jagged line with my finger on a map." That idea of something blooming inside you, that a map speaks to you, what was it, do you think, that drew you to that trail?
I've always been a lover of maps. Before I get to the trail, I just want to say that really all of my life, from my youngest days, I remember my school teacher had a big map on the wall, and I would just stare at it and imagine the adventures I could have. And so when I learned about the Pacific Crest Trail, which I'd only heard of, frankly, a few months before I began hiking it, there was that feeling, that opening, that blooming. It seemed like I felt called to go to that place. I loved the idea that there could exist this long trail, this corridor through the wilderness, that you could do something as simple as walk on. You know, it was both a very small and simple thing and a very grand thing all at once.
You say something as simple as walk on, but part of the story is the story of how unsimple it is. The sheer taxing physicality of it, and also the kind of emotional toll that walk took on you. Would you describe yourself as prepared when you began?
I think we're never prepared for the biggest, most interesting things. I was prepared to the extent that I'd been a hiker, I lived in the wilderness before, but I had so much to learn. I'd never gone backpacking before I set out on this journey, which, of course, ends up being much, you know, it's a comic piece of both the book and the film. But in real life, when it was happening to me, it wasn't funny at all. I really had a lot to learn, and I had to learn those lessons the hard way, how to carry a pack that was way too heavy for me, and how to do that thing of putting one foot in front of the other, which ended up being actually quite physically painful because I did have that heavy pack and I did have these boots I hadn't broken in.
You were also only 26 at
the
time?
Yes, I was 26.
And had just, you alluded to the things that you were in effect running away from, all the things that were making you want to get out there and connect.
Yeah.
How direct was that relationship in your mind when you went out, or is that something that you became aware of afterwards as a motivation?
It was absolutely direct. It was the reason I went and hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. For your listeners who aren't familiar with the book or the film, what happened is my mother, at the age of 45, died very suddenly of cancer a few years before I began hiking the trail. And in my grief, you know, really, she was my only parent. I didn't have a good father. I didn't have a relationship with him, and I still don't. And I just, when my mom died, I didn't know how I could live without her. And so I spiraled in my grief. I began using drugs. I was promiscuous. I did a lot of things that weren't good for me. And I sort of looked up and thought, I can't continue to live this way. I have to save myself. And that's how the idea of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail came along. I decided to do it because I wanted to find my strength again.
When we think about grief and strength, one of the things is that question about our relationship to others and the community around us. And one of the things that strikes me about this is, you know, it was such a solitary journey. It was 8 days before you came across anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
How are you with solitude? Was that what you needed, or was that the hardest part of it?
It was very intentional for me to go alone. I never thought about going with someone else. I've always loved to be alone. I'm a very social person. I'm an extrovert. But I call myself an extroverted hermit, because as much as I love to be with people, I love to be alone. I've always found that is where I can tap into, I guess, that truest voice in me. And that manifests itself in my writing life, obviously. You have to be deeply alone in order to write. And I think, for myself at least, I also had to be deeply alone to heal, to ask some of those big questions, to reach towards a kind of acceptance and forgiveness in my life at that point.
Tell me about the physical landscape, because even though you had spent time outside and in the wilderness before, this wasn't your world necessarily.
Right.
This wasn't your landscape. Tell me about those kind of first impressions. In those first few nights, didn't see another person on the trail. What of that time stays with you?
So much of it. The landscape of the PCT is spectacular. One of the most, the things I love the most about the trail is you pass through all of these different sorts of landscapes. I began my hike in Southern California in the Mojave Desert. There are Joshua trees, and it's very arid and beautiful in that kind of particular way that deserts are. And then you walk up into the Sierra Nevada, the highest mountain range in the continental U.S., into these snowy peaks. And then when you get further north into Oregon, you're entering the rainforest and the lush Pacific Northwest of the United States. And I loved moving through these landscapes at foot speed. That was very, very important to me. I think many of us have driven through beautiful landscapes in cars, and we observe them, but we don't feel them. We don't experience them. And the thing about walking is you are part of the landscape. You are not witnessing it the way you do in an automobile. You really feel, you know, the weather is you, the landscape is you. When you're walking over, you know, the kind of dirt that is in that landscape is the dirt that's in your own teeth. And I love the intimacy I had with the land. It made me, here I was alone, and I think so much of many of us think of alone as being isolated, but in fact, in that aloneness, I felt more connected than ever, and not just connected to other humans, but to the whole world.
And you felt properly present? I mean, one of the things I've never been on a hike of this magnitude, but one of the things I find when you go on a long walk is there's a point where the physical experience of it means you wind up wrapped up in your own head. entirely and you trudge and yes. you look up and suddenly the landscape's changed and suddenly it's... Did you have moments where you stopped, where you were really present on the trail rather than entirely interior?
Lost in your head. Well, I think that's the beauty of being in nature, is that we're constantly moving back and forth between those extremes, where you're walking along and you're lost in these deep thoughts that might not otherwise come to you in the world of distractions that we all have attached to our cell phones and computers and so forth. But yes, I did look up. I did stop. There was never a day that went by that I didn't feel astonishment. And when we were making the movie, I was very involved in the making of the film. I would stand there and watch Reese pretend to be me on the trail, which is a very surreal experience. But I would say to her, you know, I would see her reenacting my misery and the hardships of the trail. And between takes, I would say to her, always remember that I felt lucky and that I was always aware of the beauty that surrounded me, and carry that with you. Even in the most agonizing moments, there was a consciousness of my great fortune to be in this beautiful wild place.
How does it make you feel? I mean, it must be surreal to see someone play you, someone else play your mother, your own story up on the screen. But one of the things that strikes me about the book is how personal your relationship to that trail is and the journey is. And it must be very odd now that that relationship's public property. Do you feel protective of it?
Not really. I mean, that's part of being a writer, is that you decide to use those deepest truths, those deepest experiences, essentially for material. You know, I knew that I wanted to tell a story that other people identified with, that in so many ways could speak to the human experience. And the only way I could do that was to tap really deeply into my own life, my own experience. And you're right, I have that intimate relationship with the trail. Several times in the book, I even refer to the Pacific Crest Trail as home. It felt like home to me, I say. And it still feels like home to me. I when I go on the trail now, I always feel like, hello, peace, my beloved PCT. And that belongs only to me. No matter how much I share the story of that, the experience of it is still mine.
I was going to say, you still hike and you go back to stretches of the trail. Have you taken loved ones and other people to the trail with you? Is that something that you've consciously decided to share with people who are part of your life now rather than part of your life back in your 20s?
Indeed. I have two kids and a husband. Our children are a boy and a girl, ages 10 and 11, and they've gone hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail many times. Sometimes they do it with a good attitude, and sometimes they complain bitterly. But I have shared it with them. Yes, indeed.
Shared it with them or imposed it upon them, one or the other. That's parenting for
That's
you.
Parenting. That's parenting.
They need to have it. And so is it different for you to be there with other people? Do you find yourself making peace with the fact that when you walk the trail now, you're a very different Cheryl Strayed to the one you were last time? Or do you find yourself trying to capture some of those things that so moved and shaped you?
I feel nostalgic when I'm on the trail now. And maybe because I'm on it in such a different way. There's an enormous difference between taking a day hike, which is the thing, you know, what I've done on the PCT lately, versus living there. You know, I when I say the trail was home, it was actually home for that summer. And so in many ways, you know, I have the experience of hiking. I also have the experience of being nostalgic for that summer past, that summer of 1995, which I never imagined so many people around the world would come to know about. It really is, you know, that I went on the trail for personal and private reasons. And everything a writer does could end up in his or her work someday. But when I was walking the trail, I didn't know that hike would be a book someday. It still surprises me.
As well as being a massive fan of Wild, I was an adoring reader of your advice column, Dear Sugar, used to appear on the Rumpus and is now a podcast, Dear Sugar Radio. How much, when your identity as the author of that was made common knowledge, did you have people responding to you as the author of Wild rather than just an advice columnist in your own right?
Well, it was, and the advice column is also collected together in my book, Tiny Beautiful Things. Those, you know, the Dear Sugar column and Writing Wild really were happening at the same time. In the U.S., those books were published 4 months apart. And I wrote Wild, and as it was in the publishing pipeline, I started doing that Dear Sugar column, and it was this anonymous thing, and when I really came forward, it was right when Wild was coming out. So I feel like that those two were born together, actually. I'm both Sugar and the author of Wild.
Well, we're lucky to have both of them. Cheryl Strayed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a delight talking to you.
I've been speaking with author and memoirist Cheryl Strayed. We'll put a link to her podcast up on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. And if you've been inspired to go on a great journey, maybe a little less ambitious than Cheryl's, don't forget that heading into the festive season, there is that competition you can join. It's up on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website, and we want to know from you a place that you've been inspired to travel to because of a film. You go into the draw to win a pack of three different books. There's a prize for a listener in each state and territory. So get on the website and enter that now. From a significant and notable track to off track, coming up after Blueprint today. Anne Jones, where are you taking us off track today?
We're going to Tasmania this morning. It's going to be lots of fun. It's not particularly glamorous, though, because we're going to be looking for slime molds.
Excellent. I'm so glad, Anne. There are very few people I speak to in my week who can give me slime moulds. What slime moulds are in Tasmania?
Oh, well, there's hundreds of slime moulds in Tasmania, and in fact, they're all over the world on every single continent. And I have to say, these are the most amazing life forms that I've ever done a story on. They surprised me every single step of the way. They don't have a brain, but they hunt. And you're going to find out heaps more about them if you keep on listening to RN, because on Off Track, I'm underneath a log for most of the program looking for slime molds.
Excellent. Hunting molds. I look forward to hearing it. Thanks heaps for that, Anne.
Talk to you soon.
And we're staying outdoors for a little bit longer now, and we're moving to a woman who's combined her artistic practice as a sculptor and visual artist with her background as a florist. Her new book's a photographic project tracing the journey of plants and flowers from their growers to the Sydney Flower Market, to a studio. It's a project that takes what we might assume about the cultural and symbolic resonance of the floral and complicates it in delightful ways. It's called The Flowers, and its author Lisa Cooper joins us now. Lisa, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. So what is it about flowers? I mean, what is it about them that so captures our emotions at times of celebration and also times of grief?
It's hard to nail it down, but they're just so beautiful and extraordinary and, you know, they're kind of heaven and earth at once, I think.
Part of what I love about the project with your book is that you resist that easy move to the kind of reassuring bouquet as a kind of just basic comfort. They're richer, they're darker, you can see the relationship between them as living plants and also something that's dead or dying.
Yeah.
Is that deliberate?
Yeah, it is deliberate. I think I guess I see beauty in both the life cycle of the flower in its death as well. So I guess I use that in my work.
One of the surprising parallels you draw in the book is between floristry and butchery. Tell us about your father, who was a butcher.
Yes, my father was indeed a butcher, and I talk about in the book how he would talk to me about how he felt that in his trade, you know, there was a very strong thread of sculpture, that he felt that, he was sculpting the animal, and there's correlations between his trade and mine in that he was breaking down component parts of the animal while I seemed to build up the elemental into a larger piece of work. And I guess the tools of our trades have similarities.
You write really beautifully about the way in which you took inspiration from him, both through his work and the sculptural elements of his trade, but also the effect his illness and death had on you.
Yeah, I think that the experience of him dying when I was so young, and it wasn't just, I suppose, the moment that he died, but the long illness that he endured. So it was watching him waste away and that kind of culminating in this image of a house full of flowers had a really, really strong impact on me. And I think it's a little bit unique, because usually when you talk to people about their love of flowers or why they work with flowers, it's all usually drawn on the idea of beauty, and that they kind of grew up dancing through the flowers and loving them. And yeah, I think I have a very different point of departure for my work.
So what came first for you, the visual arts or the floristry?
The visual arts came first, but I use fresh flowers and silk flowers in the production of artworks as an artist. But I worked at a flower shop in Sydney for the years of my postgraduate work, and I fell in love with not only using flowers as a medium in art, but the trade itself. And so that was how I came to become a florist.
That point about the trade of it, I mean, both echoes what you said about your father, but also it comes across in the book in your enthusiasm for the Sydney flower markets. For listeners elsewhere in the country who don't know those markets, can you describe those for us?
Yeah, it's an enormous concrete slab brimming with flowers and buckets of water and people who work on the land daily and wake up very, very early in the morning, sometimes waking up the day before. Some of them get up at 11 o'clock in the evening to start their journey to the market. And yeah, it's just an extraordinary atmosphere, really. Lots of hard-working people who are very passionate and delirious with exhaustion and enthusiasm.
You write in the book about an image you had of Saint Therese on your bedroom wall as a young child, and the fact that it wasn't until much later in life you learnt that she was the patron saint of florists. Do you find the process of arranging flowers a meditative one?
Oh, very, very much so. Like, almost beyond what I consider meditative to kind of encapsulate. Like, it gives me a calmness. I have a calmness in my soul when I work with the flowers. So for me, it's incredible to be able to do that daily. It's such an indulgence. But yeah, it has an impact on the feeling within me that is extraordinary. Yeah.
So as a tradie, I want the tips from you. Are there tricks for spotting the best flowers to buy? What do you look out for?
They're many and varied. I mean, sometimes you can give them a little shake. Don't let the growers see you do that, but see if any little petals fall off. It's always good to look at the stem. Just look, use your eyes. I think a lot of people, I talk about this in the book, it's about observing the flowers. So pick up the flowers and look at the stem and look at, to see if they look green and bright and strong. And likewise with the blooms and the petals.
I love that you spend the whole book saying how much you love growers and how good your relationship with them is, and now you've just confessed that you secretly go and shake their flowers to get the kind of the dud ones that you leave behind.
Yeah, there's a lot more of that goes on too, but
That is dangerous and scurrilous. Is that relationship with the growers and the providers? How does that factor into your artwork that you make at the end of it?
Yeah, I think it factors in a great deal. I'm so inspired by them, and I'm so inspired by the hand that helps such extraordinary beauty come into my life and into our lives. I think it's incredible. And also as I talk about in my book, is that, you know, my mother's Italian, and so I have that heritage and the memory. And so a lot of those people that I deal with at the market remind me of my grandparents and aunts and uncles, and it feels very familiar indeed to me. So I draw that into my flower work as well. I kind of borrow from the people that they are and the memories they
call up in me into the work and the compositions that I make.
Well, it comes up beautifully in the book. The book is called The Flowers. It's published by Murdoch Books, and I've been speaking to its author, visual artist, florist, Dr. Lisa Cooper, who was speaking to us from her studio in Carriage Works, Sydney. And that's all we've got time for this week. Big thank yous to producers Maria Tickle, Kathy Pryor, and today's technical producer, Kerry Dell. Next week, the man better known as children's book sensation Lemony Snicket, Daniel Handler, shares with us his melancholy take on a beach in San Francisco, plus a plethora of design, gardening, travel, and food jibber-jabber to be going on with. Don't forget, you can get on the website and subscribe to the podcast or listen to us on the ABC Radio app or a multitude of choices. Get on there and do it. Until then, have a great week. Bye for now.